Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of the 12th of October, these are our main stories. The United States is stepping up the pressure on Turkey to rein in its offensive in northern Syria. There have been more setbacks for Facebook's ambitious plan to create a new global currency. And safety investigators have strongly criticised the US aviation regulator for granting approval to the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft, two of which have crashed. Also in this podcast.
I decided to release the pressure in my spacesuit and my gloves went back to normal. My spacesuit became more flexible.
The first person ever to walk in space, the Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov, has died at the age of 85. Turkey has come under further international pressure over its offensive against the Kurds in northeast Syria. Fierce fighting is continuing as the Turkish military tries to seize key towns on the Syrian side of the border. The latest estimate by the United Nations is that 100,000 people have so far been forced to flee their homes. Speaking at a news conference at the Pentagon, the US Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, warned Turkey its offensive against Kurdish-held areas in northern Syria could have serious consequences.
We oppose and are greatly disappointed by Turkey's decision to launch a unilateral military incursion into northern Syria. This operation puts our SDF partners in harm's way. It risks the security of ISIS prison camps and will further destabilize the region. From the president on down, we have communicated with the Turks on this issue. I spoke with Turkish Defense Minister Akar yesterday to express our strong opposition to Turkey's actions and reiterated the damage this is doing to our bilateral relationship.
Our correspondent Martin Patience reports from the Turkish town of Akçakale near the Turkey-Syria border.
In the border town of Akçakale, the funeral took place for a 9-month-old baby boy. Omar Shahar was killed when Kurdish fighters fired shells in the town. He was Syrian. His family had fled to Turkey for safety. His mother, Fatima, said she had waited 17 years for a son. The rocket hit my house, she said, and two of my daughters were badly hurt and are now in intensive care. There will be more funerals in the coming days, with several civilians killed in the Syrian towns being attacked by the Turkish military. A commander of a Syrian unit fighting alongside Turkish forces told the BBC that the Kurds were putting up a fierce fight. Despite the growing international criticism, Turkey's president insists this offensive will go on.
That was Martin Patience near the Turkey-Syria border. And as he said, the Turkish president Recep Tayyip Erdogan says he won't halt the military operation, whatever the objections of other countries.
We will never stop this step we've taken against the PYD, YPG. We will not stop it, no matter what anyone says. We're receiving threats from right and left, saying stop. We will continue the fight until all the terrorists go south of the 32-kilometre limit from our border.
Ahmet Barat Çankar is an MP for Turkey's governing AK party and deputy head of the Turkish delegation to the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. Julian Marshall asked him for his reaction to the US Defense Secretary's request to Turkey to stop the offensive in northern Syria.
I think the process has already shown us that Turkey has to make this operation and finalize this operation. Otherwise, it hasn't been possible to find a solution together with our allies, because we tried this for a very long time to make this a safe zone possible, but it hasn't been possible to work with our allies to achieve this end. So Turkey has to continue this operation, and we have very clearly set targets in this operation. And achieving this target is important for Turkey as well as the United States and our other allies, because we are trying to bring safety, security to this region, and basically resettlement chance for the Syrian refugees will be opened with the end of this operation.
Are you surprised, though, at the hostility of Western governments to what Turkey is doing? Threats in the US Congress to impose sanctions, a number of European countries cutting off arms supplies to Turkey. Did you hear those hostile voices in your NATO parliamentary meeting today?
First of all, I would say that I am very much surprised and shocked by the level of reaction from some of the countries. But in the NATO meeting, we just had a very normal conversation. They just wanted to learn more about our operation. So there was not any problem regarding that. But when you look at the reactions in the media, I would say that some of those reactions are totally out of reality, because Turkey is fighting against a terrorist group which has been a threat for more than 30 years to Turkey. Basically, we are expecting support from our allies in NATO. We have been in NATO for more than 65 years, shoulder to shoulder with our allies. And this is the day Turkey needs the support of its NATO allies.
The Turkish AK Party MP Ahmet Berat Çankar. The United States has announced it's sending thousands of extra troops to support Saudi Arabia in response to last month's strikes on the country's oil industry. Two squadrons of fighter aircraft as well as air defence systems are also being deployed. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue says the move seems intended as a deterrent.
These are sort of defensive moves in many ways. The Patriot missile batteries are designed to take out incoming missiles. That's what they're for. And the same with the THAAD system. That's aimed at taking down incoming missiles. Obviously, the fighter squadrons can be more offensive, but I think it's designed as a bit of a deterrent. There's a clear view that Iran was responsible for those attacks on the Aramco facilities, and they want to send the message that they've got this sort of assets in the area and the intent that if Iran continues to do those sorts of things, in their view, that they are prepared to take them on.
That was Gary O'Donoghue. It started with one. Last week, PayPal announced it was pulling out of Facebook's new cryptocurrency project, Libra. But that was just the start. MasterCard, eBay and the payments company Stripe have all withdrawn too, all before the service has even been launched. Our North America technology reporter Dave Lee began by explaining what Libra is and what seems to be the problem.
I think, you know, Facebook's goal was quite clear from the start on this. They thought if they could create this coalition of companies rather than just Facebook itself, then they would perhaps have more chance of getting people on board with this idea, because, of course, Facebook has some pretty big reputational problems right now. I think the fact that these companies are pulling out does represent a significant blow, both because they'll be losing some significant expertise, but also, you know, it would have been much easier for Facebook to go ahead of US politicians. And indeed, Mark Zuckerberg is due to face a congressional committee about this soon. I think he's going to find it much more difficult to convince them that they've got this under control and that it's going to be a safe thing to do.
That was Dave Lee in San Francisco. The Maasai are perhaps the most well-known tribe in Kenya and Tanzania, with their bright coloured garments and ornaments as well as their culture. The traditional Maasai lifestyle centres around livestock, which is the main source of food for the tribe. A large part of its diet consists mainly of meat, milk and blood. But as Andrew Ochieng reports from Kajiado in southwestern Kenya, there are unusually a few Maasai who are vegetarian. Just a warning, some people might find the report disturbing.
It is early morning in Anthony Mututua's homestead. He is a Maasai, one of Kenya's pastoralist communities whose lives, diet, culture and economy revolve around their livestock. There are several women and children busy in the goat pen. This is the way most Maasai start their day, milking the goats just in time for breakfast. It is a chore reserved for the women and the children. After breakfast, several villagers start gathering in this homestead for a celebration.
It's a slaughtering day here, so Anthony and his friends fetch two sheep from the pen. They drag it a distance from the house Under the shade of an old acacia tree, they first suffocate the ship by putting their hands over its mouth and nose. Then the knives are sharpened. Anthony cuts the throat of the ship. They collect blood in jugs and mugs. Once the skinning has been completed, I'm just watching as the men who have been slaughtering the sheep remove the kidney. That is the first organ that they remove from the animal. They're cutting it into small pieces and they're sharing it amongst themselves.
All of them except Anthony. That's because he's vegetarian. A very unique and rare thing in a culture where meat is central to the Maasai way of life.
Yeah, it's just a normal job. People don't mind about anything good, so you just slaughter. You give to prepare for other people to come and eat.
Anthony only drinks milk but doesn't take the blood.
I started just eating, but my body reacted. That is allergy, and I don't want to be eating more.
While the men slaughter the sheep, the women are preparing other dishes that will go with the meat. Anthony's wife, Kristin, is among them. She's preparing chapati, a flatbread that is common here and eaten with stews or vegetables. She says her husband eats vegetables like cabbage or kale with ugali, which is a maize meal. His allergies normally last 2 to 3 days, with itchy skin as one of the symptoms. Sometimes he has to go to hospital to be treated, but they have never been life-threatening, she says. One of the women gathered here is Wanjiru Ngororo, who is in her 60s. She's half Maasai, half Kikuyu, but always identified herself as Maasai. She was born and raised in Maasai country. She's been a vegetarian all her life and has never liked the taste and smell of meat.
I have never had the desire or urge to eat it. You saw my shop. It is right next to a butchery. The smell that normally comes from there, God only knows. It is just that I don't have anywhere else to go. Even when I visit my in-laws, I find that they have slaughtered, but I don't eat. I don't have the urge.
I ask Wanjiru what her family thinks.
They really don't care. It's just my daughter who sometimes asks me, "Mom, why are you not eating meat?" I tell her I just don't want. Then she says, "If you're not eating it, neither will I."
Many rituals in the Maasai culture are tied around this communal sharing of meat, and those who are vegetarian clearly stand out.
It's true that Maasai eat a lot of meat because traditionally it's the food, the staple food for Maasai is meat and blood, milk and so on.
So you're not a pure Maasai?
Okay, I'm a pure Maasai, but maybe just one the other way around if you're not to take meat. Not all people know that I don't eat it. Because when I come, I just when the other people are eating and I contribute. If they want meat, I give it up the goat for them to slaughter. And this is simple, that you are part of it because you are giving it up.
So it's a well-kept secret?
Yes, a well-kept secret.
You're very cheeky, man.
At a livestock market a few kilometers away, hundreds of Maasai men with red and blue wraps around their waist and shoulders are standing beside their goats and sheep. You're not likely to find a vegetarian in this crowd. There is little sign that vegetarianism is a growing trend, but there is acceptance of the few who choose to follow this way of life.
That report by Andrew Ochiang in southwestern Kenya. Still to come in this podcast.
In individual farmsteads, the people living in such a farmstead and working in such a farmstead were much more socially complex, stratified, as we had always thought.
The fascinating discoveries about a community in Germany almost 5,000 years ago. In April, the Federal Aviation Administration, which regulates flying in the US, asked a team of independent experts to examine how well it oversaw the Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. That's the model which has been grounded since March following two fatal crashes. The report has come back in, and both the FAA and Boeing are harshly criticised. Theo Leggett, our business correspondent, told us the investigation focused on the plane's flight control systems.
The two accidents involving the 737 MAX were triggered by the failure of a single sensor that caused a malfunction in a flight control system known as MCAS, which ultimately forced the aircraft into a dive. and the review was set up to work out how the certification of the aircraft allowed it to be flown when it had such a severe flaw. And the findings are pretty scathing in some ways, to be honest. For example, the joint agencies have decided that the FAA had inadequate awareness of what MCAS was, which, coupled with limited involvement, as it says, resulted in an inability of the FAA to provide an independent assessment of the adequacy of what Boeing was proposing. And another problem was that Boeing employees who were carrying out tasks on behalf of the FAA as part of the certification process were, it says, put under undue pressures. In other words, there seemed to be a conflict of interest.
Now, the FAA is relied upon by all air passengers to ensure that civil aviation in the US is safe. So how bad does this look for the FAA?
It looks pretty bad, but you have to have some sympathy for the FAA, because what it does is it delegates a huge amount of its safety certification work to Boeing. You could say that Boeing is marking its own homework. Now, why does this happen? Well, because the FAA is a government organisation with a limited budget. Boeing is a massive commercial organisation with vast revenues and an enormous amount of expertise. So in a way, the only way that this work can get done is if some of it is delegated to Boeing itself. And over the years, US politicians have been very complicit in this. They don't want to give the FAA a lot more money, so it's easier to endorse a process whereby more and more work is delegated to the manufacturer itself.
This, obviously, this report has only come out today, but does this suggest that the FAA is going to have to rethink the expertise it buys in from the manufacturers themselves?
Well, it's certainly going to have to find a different way of doing it. I mean, what this report is not just a set of criticisms, but also a large set of recommendations about how things could be done better. And the administrator of the FAA has already said he'll take account of what he calls this unvarnished report, and he will look at what could be done better. But there is no question that the FAA and Boeing have come out of this affair pretty badly.
That was our business correspondent, Theo Leggett. The European Union's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, has outlined several persistent obstacles to a deal. As EU ambassadors asked him to intensify negotiations, he told them that Britain accepts that a customs border can't be imposed anywhere in Ireland, but still insists that Northern Ireland cannot be separated from the UK's customs territory. Mr. Barnier said he would only accept a solution guaranteed to avoid a hard border in Ireland. Britain has proposed giving Northern Ireland a way out of any ties with the EU in the event of a stalemate over the future relationship. From Brussels, our Europe correspondent, Kevin Connolly.
There is no mistaking the change in atmosphere in Brussels in the 24 hours since Boris Johnson met his Irish counterpart Leo Varadkar. But for the moment, there's no explaining it either. Donald Tusk, who was accusing Mr. Johnson of a stupid blame game earlier in the week, is still cautious. But he did acknowledge the improving mood.
I have received promising signals from the Taoiseach that a deal is still possible. Of course, there's no guarantee of success and the time is practically up. But even the slightest chance must be used.
It's widely thought in Brussels that any prospect of progress must be based on movement in the British position on the future customs status of Northern Ireland, and presumably acceptance that there can't be a customs border on the island of Ireland, as the EU has always insisted. That might mean some form of checks in the Irish Sea, which were once regarded as out of the question. After his meeting, Michel Barnier gave away no detail, offering instead one of his favourite mountaineering metaphors for the Brexit process.
Brexit is like climbing a mountain. We need vigilance, determination and patience.
In Brussels, there is a negotiating concept called the tunnel, an intensified period of talks without leaks or briefings, where both sides can see the light of agreement, even if it's a little distant, at the end. The EU has been cautious about publicly declaring this to be a tunnel, in case it implies that agreement is close. The timeframe to get a deal, before next week's summit of EU leaders here in Brussels, is forbiddingly tight.
That was Kevin Connolly in Brussels. And don't forget that we want your questions for a global Brexit cast special coming up later this month. And I will remind you of the details of that later on. Scientists have used ancient DNA to reconstruct the family trees of dozens of individuals who lived in a small valley in Germany thousands of years ago. The study in the Lech River Valley in Bavaria is the first of its kind. Excavations have uncovered dozens of skeletons dating back as far as almost 5,000 years. Julian Marshall spoke to the archaeologist Philip Stockhammer, who co-led the study.
We discovered that in individual farmsteads, the people living in such a farmstead and working in such a farmstead were much more socially complex, stratified, as we had always thought that it could be in the deep Bronze Age. You know, originally, people were thinking that the Bronze Age farmsteads were organized something on a biologically related family basis. What we could show is that we have complex households with different kind of people inside such a household, biologically related or not related, rich and poor, foreign and local. So these early households were much more complex than we had ever thought they would be.
And your repeated use of the word biological points to the fact that you've been able to reveal certain facts that might not have been possible had you not used DNA.
Yep. I mean, this is what made our study so innovative, that we were the first to create so long biological, basically family pedigrees. You know, in the past, this had not been possible with the previous methods in archaeogenetics, but now we are really able to transform cemeteries into family trees. And on the basis of these sophisticated family trees, we could get insights that we managed to get.
I mean, not everybody's happy with this development, are they? Not all archaeologists.
No, that's true. I mean, in the last, let's say, 10 years, the results that were gained by archaeogenetics have really posed an important challenge to the archaeological community. I mean, you have to see there have been 50, 100 years of studying in certain aspects, and then suddenly comes a 35-year-old geneticist and tells archaeologists that have been working on a certain topic for decades that he or she has some proof that everything was completely different. You know, this is something that is a challenge to a discipline, that traditional narratives and traditions of research suddenly get challenged by people that have never dealt with human history before.
Philip Stockhammer, an archaeologist at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich. Tokyo is preparing to face what could be its biggest storm in 60 years. Typhoon Hagibis is expected to bring wind speeds of over 200 kilometres an hour when it makes landfall on Saturday. And as Japanese citizens steel themselves, a potential legal battle prompted by the typhoon is threatening to engulf the Rugby World Cup. Jonathan Savage reports.
The joke among Scottish sports fans is that while we're weary of having our dreams crushed, at least our teams tend to mess everything up in new and creative ways. But to lose out as a result of a combination of weather and bureaucracy? Well, fate has really outdone itself this time. The Scots need to beat Japan in their final group game to make it through to the knockout stages of the Rugby World Cup. But the tournament's organisers are threatening to deny Scotland the right to win or lose on the pitch. If Typhoon Hagibis means Sunday's game in Yokohama can't be played, they'll rule it a scoreless draw, putting the Scots on the next plane home. Well, the Scottish Rugby Union aren't putting up with that. They've had legal advice saying the game could still be moved to another day or city. Mark Dodson is Scottish Rugby's chief executive.
This is a massive stage for us to perform on. To have it taken away is pretty difficult for an organisation like us. We're not being aggressive, we're being constructive, and we've tried to have dialogue. I think in the court of public opinion, we've already won. I think you can see from social media that people feel that this doesn't feel quite right. And I think most people feel that if it was one of the economic powerhouses of the game, let's just say New Zealand, perhaps more thought would be given to a flexible approach.
World Rugby says the rules on postponed matches were clear all along. And besides, the scale of the typhoon and the complexity of organising the event mean their hands are tied. But should this have been foreseen? Is this time of year too meteorologically risky to hold a major outdoor sporting event? No, says Daniel Redor from data specialists Refinitiv.
If you look back at the records, there's only been two typhoons to hit central Japan in October. and this would be the strongest. Probability and odds-wise, October makes sense to hold such an event. It's unlucky.
A decision on Japan versus Scotland will be made in the coming hours. Meanwhile, two other games scheduled for Saturday have been postponed and ruled as 0-0 draws. The qualifying session for the Japanese Grand Prix has been moved from Saturday to Sunday morning, the same day as the race. If conditions haven't let up by then, time set in Friday's practice session will determine the grid.
That was Jonathan Savage. The first person ever to step out of a spacecraft and walk in space, the Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov, has died at the age of 85. Born in Siberia in 1934, Leonov was among the first group of Soviet Air Force pilots selected to take part in the cosmonaut training program. His pioneering step into the unknown took place in 1965 during the Cold War battle for supremacy in space between the USSR and the United States. In January 2016, James Kumarasamy spoke to Alexei Leonov and asked him about his famous mission into space.
I knew my assignment. I knew what to do and when. I had it all in my head, and I was following the instructions step by step. Every second was planned, and it went according to plan. We lifted off from the Black Sea coast in Crimea. I confirmed I was ready, and Yuri Gagarin said, "Mission launched." I was looking down, and there was so much going on in my head. I saw the Mediterranean Sea, Turkey, and then Africa, the whole continent. And then, apparently, I said, "The Earth is round." I don't even remember saying it. I don't know why I'd say something like that, but it's on record, so I must have said it. I remember that I was so impressed with how everything looked from above. The Black Sea looked exactly the same as it did on a map. Then Crimea, Romania, Bulgaria, Greece, Italy. You can see everything. It's clear and quiet. You can hear your deep breath and your heartbeat. Чак, чак.
И как работает сердце. Тук-тук.
It was amazing. The stars were everywhere. On the earth, we see them above us, but there, they were surrounding me from all sides. I had to get my coordinates right. What's above me, what's beneath me? I had to ask myself. I quickly managed to answer that. The sun was above me. It was important not to think that the Earth had to be under my feet because it could be anywhere.
When did you realize there was something not right with the spacesuit?
У меня была фотокамера Ajax.
I had a camera and I tried to take photos, but something wasn't working. It was something I'd done so many times on Earth. So I realized immediately that something wasn't right. The footage shows me trying to lean forward. 8 minutes into my odyssey, my fingers came out of the gloves. My feet came out of my boots, but I was still thinking about filming. How will I work with these gloves, I asked myself. How will I manage? I pushed myself away to reach the camera, and suddenly there was a bigger problem. The space shuttle is normally stable. It has to be. But as I moved, it started wobbling. I ended up in an electromagnetic field, which was totally unexpected. This had never happened during the tests. So as I pushed myself away, the shuttle moved with me, and the sun was suddenly shining into my face. The camera was damaged by the direct sunlight. This is how aggressive the sun was.
Какая концентрация солнечного потока?
You had to get back to Earth.
Так вот, я сделал на скафандре.
I decided to release the pressure in my spacesuit, and my gloves went back to normal. My spacesuit became more flexible. It was really dangerous. I could have died.
The words of the Russian cosmonaut Alexei Leonov, the first person to walk in space, who has died at the age of 85. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this one or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email, the address globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And remember that we also want to have your questions for the forthcoming, at a date to be confirmed, Global Brexit Cast Special, when you can ask our own four experts on Brexit, Chris Mason, Katia Adler, Laura Koonsberg and Adam Fleming, anything you want to know about Brexit. They have lived and breathed all the twists and turns of this since June 2016, and if it's possible to know, they know it. The usual address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or you can tweet me using the hashtag GlobalNewsPod. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.